Few things in life are truly once-in-a-lifetime experiences. This is one of them. August 6th, 1975. You pick up the New York Times, flipping from the front fold. Malaysia terrorists free most hostages in embassy. To the back fold. In the bottom right corner, a painting of a dandy, egg-headed, mustachioed man beneath the headline, Hercule Poirot is dead, famed Belgian detective. You know, actually everyone knows from Belgium to Bangladesh, that Hercule Poirot can't be dead, not in the way that Rod Serling died about a month back, or MODOK the elephant, the oldest known non-human mammal, died a few days ago at 78. Hercule Poirot, a Belgian detective who became internationally famous, has died in England. His age was unknown. If Hercule Poirot has died, in quotes, that is big news. Poirot has been solving impossible-to-solve crimes for your entire life. But this front page of The Grey Lady looks like real news, the kind of somber front page obituary that you would give to someone like Irish freedom fighter Eamon de Valera, who will die later in the month and get a similar-looking obit. There's no indication, unless you dig all the way down to the bottom of paragraph 2, that this is no ordinary obituary. His career, as chronicled in the novels of Dame Agatha Christie, was one of the most illustrious in fiction. It is the first time you have ever seen the Times honor a fictional person with an obituary, let alone on the front page. It's the last time you'll see it as well. But to be fair, when will you ever see another author write the same character consistently across a 50-plus year span? And then, after all those decades, have the gumption and the foresight to write that beloved character's death? The date of Poirot's death is August 6th, 1975. That's the date his death was confirmed by Dodd Mead, Dame Agatha's publishers. The date of death is October 15th, 1975. That's the date Dodd Mead put out Curtain, the novel that chronicles his last days. The date of death is sometime in 1940. That's when Agatha Christie locked Curtain, Poirot's last case, in a vault with the promise that it wouldn't be opened until her death, and then, knowing full well how her most famous detective would die, went on writing cases for Poirot for decades. The date of death is never. David Suchet played Poirot on ITV for 24 years. 24 years! From 1989 to his own Curtain call in 2013, and still, Poirot lives. A new official Poirot novel came out in 2016, the second written by Sophie Hanna. She will write at least two more.
You know, there is something about a tangle of strangers pressed together for days with nothing in common but the need to go from one place to another and never see each other again.
And Poirot was just in a cinema near you, his mustache more voluptuous than ever. And a sequel has been promised. Perhaps Kenneth Branagh will play Poirot for decades until he too sends the detective off with his own version of Curtain. And still, Poirot will live on. He will outlive us all. This is Iconography, a podcast about the geography of icons, real and imagined. This episode, The Death of Poirot.
It'll be tough for us to try them with only 10 jurors. I don't know if that's legal. I guess I don't know much about the legal system here.
I was a jury member in an Agatha Christie story once.
Oh, yay, good.
Phew, now it's legal. Binding.
There's no mistrial for that.
Sorry, I have to declare a mistrial. There's only 10 out of 12 jurors.
Actually, because the symmetry was just too good to pass up, and also because it's so teensy tiny that it fits anywhere and I can carry it with me at all times, I've written some of this episode in my juror's notebook. I should clarify. Our place in London is about a 3-minute walk from the south end of Westminster Bridge. You know, the one, Big Ben and the Houses of Parliament in the northwest corner? Well, catty corner from Ben, behind the London Eye, is a grand building called County Hall, which no longer acts as a county hall. Now it has a ritzy Marriott, and an aquarium, Shrek's Adventure, and for the next few months, it's the home of a really nifty new staging of Agatha Christie's Witness for the Prosecution. Originally written as a short story that Christie didn't care for very much, adapted into a play quite grudgingly after much prodding, Witness for the Prosecution takes place mostly, but not entirely, in a courtroom, where an adorable baby-faced rube, Leonard Vole, is being tried for the murder of a rich woman he befriended.
Leonard Vole, you are charged on indictment for that you, on the 14th day of October, killed Emily Jane French. Are you guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty.
The big selling point for the County Hall production is that it takes place in the old council chambers of the London Community Council, a wood-paneled room that appears to be the kind of room cigars and brandy would build, if they could build a room. Considering they were putting on this show basically on our street, we had to go, and Carolyn wanted to go big. The VIP experience at this production is sitting in the jury seats, and not just because they're the best seats in the house or because you get drink vouchers and a program with your ticket, though that's a nice bonus. You're also part of the play in really fascinating ways. Whenever lawyers are making their argument and witnesses are making their statement, you are their focus.
The question the jury must ask themselves is, were you lying then,
or are you lying now?
The judge, the actor playing the judge, you have to remind yourself, is actually speaking to you when he tells the jury to disregard something that was said. As such, when a scene is set in the courtroom, the bright stage lights are on you as well as the actors. So, look dignified. One of you will even get to stand up and deliver the verdict. Though, of course, you don't get a choice as to what the verdict will be. Dame Agatha will have her way. And no, I didn't get to be the foreman when we went. It really keeps you on your toes being constantly stared down by men in wigs as this young man's life hangs in the balance. Even though it's a fictional life, you're trying extra hard to work out what you would do if you were on this jury. But the beauty of the play, even if you're not a sworn-in member of the fake jury, is that you do see enough of the trial to feel you have a full picture, and you do make your own call. I won't say which way you lean, but after a thundering last-act revelation, it's going to be exactly the way that everyone else is leaning, unless they happen to be a contrarian or a clairvoyant. Why? Because Agatha Christie knows you. She knows what you think about crime. She knows what you think about the people who commit crime and the people who don't. And she plays you like a fiddle. This is especially true, actually, of another Agatha Christie play that's been running for a bit longer than Witness has been running at County Hall. The Mousetrap opened on the West End in 1952 with Richard Attenborough in the cast. Think about that for a minute. The Mousetrap started playing when John Hammond was a young man, and it's still there, nine times a week, with a cast that rotates about once a year. And I don't think it's because the bookers at the theater are lazy and don't want to find new tenants, or because the Mousetrap's own longevity has become a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. The Mousetrap is a cracking yarn, with surprisingly a parodist's attitude to the conventions of the genre, Christie practically being a genre unto herself. Yeah, you heard me right. The dame's got jokes, and she's willing to lob them at herself. And the ending is so surprising you feel giddy from the fall you just experienced when you had the rug pulled out from under you. The facts are all right there staring you in the face, and only one lie stops you from seeing them. But it's a lie that 99% of us will just intrinsically, instinctively believe, so we are blind to the truth. The constant refrain of Three Blind Mice practically mocks our short-sightedness. In both plays, I not only didn't see the ending coming, everyone tries to see through Aggie's puzzles and so if you can, I was delighted by the audacity of the solution, because in both she's toying with us, with our expectations. It can't be that person, not because of alibis or motive, but because of human nature, because of whose stories train us to trust. Yeah, she betrays us, and we love it. And you want to preserve that feeling, that upending, for someone else. It's one of the delights of life, to experience it fresh. At the end of The Mousetrap, during the bows, the actor who plays the murderer entreats you to keep his secret. It's a nice gesture, but, like, barring a star-studded film of The Mousetrap, which isn't going to happen, it's just a gesture. The play simply does not have a high enough profile for its ending to be so saturated in the culture that people just know it. You know, like, The Sixth Sense, or Empire Strikes Back, or, for that matter, Christie's own Murder on the Orient Express. Come to think of it, why doesn't it have a high enough profile? We don't talk enough about Agatha Christie as a playwright, or, for that matter, Agatha Christie as a postmodernist, as a deconstructor of stories, not the matronly spinner of cozy murder yarns that she gets thought of as, but the young author who shocked the literary world, who infuriated people by having a narrator who turned out to be the murderer. When we talk about Agatha Christie, we don't talk about a lot of things that deserve discussion. Why is that?
Morning, sir. I've got a parrot with Mr. Poirot.
No. Poirot. It is pronounced Poirot.
Oh, right.
This is the world's most celebrated crime fighter.
I take a professional interest in crime.
Agatha Christie's brilliant Belgian detective.
I do not think that formal introductions are necessary. Poirot. Hercule Poirot. There are those who have called me the greatest detective of all time, a description with which I find it difficult to quarrel.
My name is Hercule Poirot, and I am probably the greatest detective in the world.
We are friends and partners, Christie wrote of Poirot when introducing Appointment with Death in 1938, already a ridiculous 22 years into their relationship. Now, before you go getting the warm fuzzies, she continued, I am beholden to him financially. On the other hand, he owes his very existence to me. In moments of irritation, I point out that by a few strokes of the pen or taps on the typewriter, I could destroy him utterly. He replies grandiloquently, impossible to get rid of Hercule Poirot like that. He is much too clever. And so, as usual, the little man has the last word. That sounds more like a standoff or hostage situation than a friendship or partnership. And it's a little disingenuous, considering Christie would soon make, and actually might have already had the idea for, another Appointment with Death. Poirot's appointment with his maker. There are two great mysteries in Agatha Christie's life. Major turning points in her career that seem hazy, no matter how many letters we read, no matter how much we learn, how much we think we know. The first is an episode for another time. What really happened during those 11 days when Agatha, devastated by the twin catastrophes of her mother's death and her husband's infidelity, disappeared, only to reappear at a hotel under an assumed name with amnesia. Sounds like it was pulled right from an Agatha Christie novel, doesn't it? You're not the first one to think so. Plenty of artists have used this juicy disappearance as fodder for their own stories, and plenty more will. I'll personally be disappointed if in a few years we don't see a disappearance of Agatha Christie drama starring Saoirse Ronan, a dead ringer for young Agatha Christie and as fine a performer as there is in the world. Less adapted is the second great mystery, perhaps because it's so much more cerebral. There's no alias on a hotel register, no car abandoned on the side of a road, no amnesia diagnosis. But still, it is an intriguing little mystery, a why done it rather than a who done it. What on earth possessed Agatha Christie to entertain killing the goose that laid her golden egg? To my knowledge, only one artist has fictionalized the mystery behind the death of Poirot. And we've actually met him a few episodes back when he was telling us about M.R. James.
I think James was the absolute master.
Why do you think that is? What does James have that others don't?
He's a great manipulator, like all great storytellers.
About a decade after director Lawrence Gordon Clark wrapped his cycle of ghost stories for Christmas on the BBC, he directed a 50-minute-long meta fever dream in which Poirot confronts his maker and she, I kid you not, tries to poison him with potassium cyanide.
One of the best compliments I ever had. They said, Miss Agatha Christie knows her job. They said, she deals with poisons. In a very knowledgeable way.
Murder by the Book begins with the agent Agatha Christie reviewing her old manuscript for Curtin in preparation for its release. She falls asleep and wakes to find that her help are missing, but they've been replaced by Ian Holm in a pretty obvious egg-shaped head prosthetic.
My dear madam, I beg you to excuse me for... deranging you at this most inappropriate hour.
This is Poirot, Christie's creation, come to life to investigate his own imminent murder.
Let us not beat under the bush.
About
the bush. I think you know quite well, my dear Agatha, who is the murderer.
He is preening and pissed.
Why, Agatha?
I beg your pardon?
I said, why? Why do you want to kill me?
This is absurd. It's getting very late, Monsieur Poirot. I really must insist.
Sit down!
It is absurd, but occasionally it is deliciously so. Not so much when Poirot is chasing Agatha around with a pistol, or when she ponders the bottle marked potassium cyanide on the table, but when the two sit down and talk about why the world's best-selling author might want to kill the world's best-selling character. The synapses of Agatha Christie's mind turned into a two-person drawing room play. It's a neat thought exercise. And I think we can use it as a sort of rubric to help us, as Poirot would say, and does say in Murder by the Book.
Examine the facts and arrange them in their proper order. Those of importance, we will put on one side. Those of no importance, blow them away.
Now, the most poetic option, the one you'd pick if you were writing a screenplay about Agatha Christie and needed a tear-jerking ending, the aged dame losing a battle against time and putting that angst on the page in the form of a withering Poirot. Those notions, well, we can
blow them away.
Agatha Christie was not an old woman when she wrote Poirot's Final Days.
The significance of the fact that you wrote this book so many years ago will, of course, not be lost on you. Had you produced it, par exemple, this year or last year, one might excuse it as a wish, albeit a misguided one, to see our two great careers terminate at approximately the same time. If, however, it was written in 1939...
1940. At 50, 36 years before her death, she was a rock star at the very peak of her craft.
That throws a very different light on the matter, for I, as you, madame, was then at the very pinnacle of my career.
But just because Christie wasn't old does not mean that she wasn't preoccupied with death, possibly her own death, when she wrote Curtain in 1940.
You see, Hercule, it was wartime. You, of all people who came to England as a refugee, must know what it feels like. It's a very emotional time. We were bombed, you know. We were away at the time, but we were actually bombed. Three houses on the other side of Sheffield Terrace, not flat. One begins to think that at any moment it might be one's own turn to die. I suddenly realized that the Germans might drop a bomb on me, and then, bang, I'd be gone, and where would that leave you?
So as Agatha wrote Poirot's death and sealed it with a "Do not open until I die," she wasn't thinking Curtain would be published in the mid-70s. She must have been operating under the assumption that her appointment with death might very well come in the 40s. By the end of the year, maybe. Perhaps before she'd even finish writing. Tomorrow night, even. She wrote a Marple and a Poirot, one for each of her children, so they would have a financial cushion if she died. "It will cheer you up," Christie said she told her children in her autobiography, "when you come back from the funeral, or the memorial service, to think that you have a couple of books, one belonging to each of you." They said they would rather have me, and I said, "I should hope so indeed." And we all laughed a good deal. Dark humor in the Christie household. But it highlights an important point. Agatha was realistic about death. "I cannot see why people are always so embarrassed about having to discuss anything to do with death," she wrote. And it can sometimes seem like her great mission in life was making the masses discuss it out in the open, cope with the fragility of human life, how squishy we are, how many things we cannot, in fact, imbibe, how easy it is for us to die. With two exceptions, two characters who seemed immune to the caprices of time, who seemed immortal. Poirot and Miss Marple. Miss Marple was born at the age of 65 to 70, which, as with Poirot, proved most unfortunate, because she was going to have to last a long time in my life. If I had had any second sight, I would have provided myself with the precocious schoolboy as my first detective. Then he could have grown old with me. Instead, when she dreamt up her first detective, the one designed to untangle her mysterious affair at Stiles in 1920, she thought, how about a refugee police officer? A retired police officer, not too young a one. Her retired police officer ended up being so advanced in age that his young friend Captain Hastings, whenever he can't figure out why Poirot was obsessed with seemingly trivial clues and dismissive of obvious ones, blames the man's failing mind. The idea crossed my mind, not for the first time, that poor old Poirot was growing old. Writing in the 60s, with the hindsight of 4 decades, Agatha reminisced, "What a mistake I made there. The result is that my fictional detective must really be well over 100 by now." Which brings us to our next possible motive for Poirot's death. It just made practical sense for him to wrestle with his mortality, even as early as 1940. In Murder by the Book, Agatha explains to Poirot,
"You were simply getting too old. You see, I made a dreadful mistake. I made you too old right at the beginning at Stiles. That was, let me see, 1920. And after that, I had to make you a bit older with each book. You know, readers spot these things. Anyway, by 1940, you'd had a good run for your money. You were pushing 80. That's too old, isn't it? For a detective. To be effective."
For decades, young Arthur Hastings, who we met at Stiles, aged. He married, moved away from England, lost his hair, eventually stopped showing up at all. And yet his old friend, mon ami Poirot, seemingly did not. And then, in Curtin, all those years seemed suddenly to catch up with Poirot as if this Dorian Gray had finally seen his portrait. Captain Hastings, returning to Stiles as an old man with a grown daughter, introduces Hercule Poirot in Curtin thusly, "Nothing is so sad, in my opinion, as the devastation wrought by age. My poor friend, I have described him many times. Now, to convey to you the difference, crippled with arthritis, he propelled himself about in a wheeled chair. His once plump frame had fallen in. He was a thin little man now. His face was lined and wrinkled. His moustache and hair were still of a jet-black colour, but candidly, though I would not for the world have hurt his feelings by saying so to him, this was a mistake. There had been a time when I had been surprised to learn that the blackness of Poirot's hair came from the bottle, but now the theatricality was apparent and merely created the impression that he wore a wig and had adorned his upper lip to amuse the children.
Me, said Poirot with a grimace, I am a wreck, I am a ruin, I am crippled and twisted. Mercifully, I can still feed myself.
Oh, merci, madame.
But otherwise, I have to be attended like a baby, put to bed, washed and dressed.
Shummy! La femme infidèle!
The public will not tolerate it. It shall not be permitted.
Reading this passage, that's what pushes Ian Holmes Poirot into his gun-toting rampage. Certainly Murder by the Book's weirdest moment, which is saying something. But the chase ends quite touchingly.
Kill me.
I beg your pardon?
Take it. Allez-y, kill me. Show me that you have the courage to do it in a decent, honorable way. Not in the cowardly, squally, humiliating ways that you planned.
The tension of the script comes not so much from Poirot's unwillingness to die, but from his feeling that he is being punished with a miserable death, an undignified death unworthy of
the world's greatest ever detective, one who earned you virtually every penny you own. I have a little idea about your motive for wanting me dead.
Oh, yes?
Oh, yes. Jealousy.
Jealousy?
jealousy. You are jealous of me, jealous of my fame, jealous of my reputation throughout the world. You resented the fact that it was my name, not yours, that sold your books. Cause c'était moi, Hercule Poirot!
The movie hand waves away all the other motives, the financial instability of the war years, the practicality of making an old man finally confront his mortality, and finally it has Agatha admit that yes, she did relish the thought of a world without Poirot.
Well, you were beginning to get in the way, a bit.
Get in the way?
Yes, a bit. You see, I liked writing lots of different sorts of things. I mean, I liked my Miss Marple books. I liked writing other murder stories without being tied.
She liked writing plays that made light of her own conventions. She relished the 19 years when she got to secretly write novels as Mary Westmacott before someone blew up her spot. She loved it so much, poured so much of herself into it, that she wrote two more novels as Mary, even when everyone knew Mary was Agatha.
But they kept insisting, Agatha, we've got to have a new Poirot book. Can't you put Poirot in this, Poirot in that? So I just obeyed orders. It spoiled things, you see. I mean, sad Cyprus. They forced me to put you in that. Completely ruined. Didn't need you much better without you. But no. Got to have Poirot in it. Nobody'll mind so long as it's Poirot. Well, I minded. Anyway, there you are.
This may be the least interesting thing about a very surreal 50-minute experience.
I hadn't realized quite how jealous you were.
Jealous!
Not that it cops out and has Agatha wake up from a dream at the end, though that is pretty lame.
Agatha?
It's that it decides that Agatha wrote a novel. What she thought at the time may have been the last novel she wrote before a German bomb took her out. Why, because she felt trapped by the success of her first creation? As if she weren't in control of his success? And the only way to regain control was to end him? This is nonsense, of course, Laura Miller wrote while celebrating David Suchet's final performance as Hercule Poirot. As Christie's biographer, I read hundreds of her letters and notes, and I found not one reference to her fabled dislike for Poirot. On the contrary, she treated him with intense protectiveness. I don't suppose, she wrote to her agent, there could be any misery greater for an author than to see their characters completely distorted. If Agatha Christie thought of Poirot as rather insufferable, most public men are who live too long, and if she refused to bring Poirot and Marple together because she believed that Hercule Poirot, the complete egoist, would not like being taught his business by an elderly spinster lady. Well, I mean, Poirot was her insufferable egoist. Poirot was a persnickety popinjay, but by design. And his social limitations created interesting situations, both for a writer to write and for a reader to read. Rather than positing that Christie only kept writing Poirot at the insistence of the money men around her, why not give her a bit more credit than that? A writer of her caliber, who seemingly could not help but create iconic characters and situations, kept one character in the public eye for over a half century. And to do that, she needed to invent new challenges for him. He was not a man easily challenged. She was his perfect match. And at her peak, she really challenged him. Not just to solve cases, but to solve humans. When Christie really hit her stride, she was wrestling with crime and its slippery relationship with justice. She was still consumed with mortality, as she had always been and would always be, but in the novels that led up to her secret 1940 authoring of Poirot's death, her most popular, most enduring novels, she was just as concerned with morality. Call it the morality of mortality. In 1936's The ABC Murders, for instance, she implicates her readers. She basically pulls a Law and Order criminal intent, interspersing Poirot's meticulous investigation of a series of alphabetically themed murders with periodic visits to the creepy loner who's always near the scene of the crime. We think We are reading a book about how Poirot will catch up to a killer whom we've already met and have already judged guilty. Only Poirot seems to realize this is not that kind of book at all. You can't judge a book, after all, by its cover. Christie relished playing these kinds of games with her readers, like the aforementioned narrator who turns out to be the murderer, or, tell me if you've heard this one, the whodunit where you try and figure out which of the 12 passengers on a luxury train did it, and it turns out they all did it.
12 people. And 12 wounds. In the body of Cassetti.
12 members of a jury.
In 1934's Murder on the Orient Express, 12 people commit an obvious crime. They murder a murderer who slipped through the American legal system, acting as judge, 12-person jury, and finally executioner. And Poirot, with little fanfare, states the facts at the end and then he steps aside, leaving the decision in the hands of two other men. You decide if I should tell the authorities the lie I have been presented, or the truth about these 12 people. The two men choose the lie, and Poirot assents, calmly. He seems satisfied that justice has been served. Now, some adapters of Orient Express do not agree with this laissez-faire version of Poirot. They want him to evangelize for truth, to proselytize for order. He is a man of order who can have nothing out of place, after all.
There was right, there was wrong. Now there is you. I cannot judge this. You must decide. You wish to go free without punishment for your crime? Then you must only commit one more. I will not stop you.
Kenneth Branagh's Poirot gives the perpetrators a test. He hands them a gun and tells them they will have to shoot him to go free.
You must silence me. Book can lie. I cannot. Do it! One of you!
Don't. I already died with Daisy.
Their leader chooses instead to shoot herself, pulling the trigger on what turns out to be an unloaded pistol. Poirot has proven that these people murdered, but they are not murderers. The long-running Poirot series starring David Suchet comes to a very similar conclusion. Truly bad people would have no qualms murdering again in order to get away with their first murder, and these are not those people. This Poirot, who cannot square the perpetrator's acts with his Christianity, practically folds in on himself in indignance.
You have no right to take the law into your own hands!
Monsieur Poirot, she was 5 years old! We were good, civilized people, and then evil got over the wall, and we looked to the law for justice. And the law let us down.
No, you behave like this and we become just savages in the street. The juries and executioners, that they elect themselves. No, it is medieval. The rule of law, it must be held high. And if it falls, you pick it up and hold it even higher. For all society, all civilized people will have nothing to shelter them if it is destroyed.
There's a higher justice than the rule of law, monsieur.
Then you let God administer it, not you!
His friend, Monsieur Bou, bellows that this murder was fair.
It's true, monsieur. You can't tell these people are good people. That Cassetti, he deserved to be executed for what he did, and the world knows it was a prophecy that he was not!
But Poirot stands his ground, ordering that the criminals be locked in until authorities arrive. Only a clear display that these grieving souls have a very clear sense of right and wrong manages to reach Poirot.
Colonel!
We have assigned one murder to the assassin, we can assign two more.
We are not murderers, Colonel.
Open the door!
Killing Cassetti was God's locker now.
Open the door!
Kill them, John, you're no better than Cassetti!
Get out of my way!
No! No! No.
we kill them, we'll become like gangsters. Just protecting ourselves. God knows how hard it would be to carry Cassetti's murder through our lives. But how unconscionable will it be to carry matters that are wrong? We don't do what is wrong, my darling. We don't do what is wrong.
And even then, he deliberates.
I asked God. I think we all did what we should do. And he said, do what is right. And I thought if I did, it would make me complete again.
And are you?
But I did what was right.
This is the Poirot we want. But it isn't the Poirot Agatha Christie gives us. Christie's Poirot does not keep himself up at night worrying about justice. His first time out at Stiles in 1920, Poirot pretty much knows the outcome from the outset, but he needs to wait for the legal system to catch up. First, he makes sure the murderer doesn't get arrested, because the murderer has an airtight alibi in his back pocket that would instantly get him acquitted. And then, Poirot allows a man he knows didn't commit the murder to be tried for it, because he knows he won't be found guilty, and the trial will help rekindle his failing marriage. He's playing matchmaker in his spare time. Only after all that does Poirot finally step in and give his first of many fireside lectures on who the true perpetrator was. He is literally running circles around everyone else. And so we arrive at 1939 and 1940, when Agatha Christie must have been particularly occupied with the quandary of people who commit murder legally. That is, they cause a death, but they do so within the bounds of the law. No charge of murder would stick, no jury would convict. As Christie sketched out Poirot's last case, a reunion of the ailing detective and his old friend Hastings at Stiles, the site of their first investigation together, she was fresh off the publication of the novel which would become her best-selling story of all time, And Then There Were None. A nasty piece of work, which sees 10 house guests, all of them responsible in some way for a death, picked off one by one by a mysterious assailant.
I have a definite sadistic delight in seeing or causing death, the murderer explains. But side by side with this went a contradictory trait, a strong sense of justice. It is abhorrent to me that any innocent person or creature should suffer or die by any act of mine. I have always felt strongly that right should prevail. It may be understood, I think a psychologist would understand, that with my mental makeup being what it was, I adopted the law as my profession. The legal profession satisfied nearly all my instincts.
What's remarkable reading And Then There Were None and Curtain back to back, which may very well be the order in which Christie processed them, is the surprising revelation that for Poirot's swan song, Christie wrote her white hat detective into very nearly the same role as one of her most malicious black hats, the nefarious And Then There Were None murderer who picks off 10 house guests until there were none. Poirot's farewell note.
Yes, my friend, it is odd and laughable and terrible. I, who do not approve of murder, I who value human life, have ended my career by committing murder. Perhaps it is because I have been too self-righteous, too conscious of rectitude, that this terrible dilemma had to come to me. For you see, Hastings, there are two sides to it. It is my work in life to save the innocent, to prevent murder. And this is the only way I can do it.
Both men are dying. And, as their last acts, they choose to murder those who they feel have escaped justice. Criminals who, in a technical sense, committed no crime.
It was a doctor to whom I was talking, some ordinary, undistinguished GP. He mentioned casually how often murder must be committed, which the law was unable to touch.
Make no mistake, X could not be touched by the law. He was safe. By no ingenuity that I could think of, could he be defeated any other way.
Both men leave posthumous notes confessing what they did and why they did it. It's not about getting away with it for these two. And both men are so meticulous, such fuss budgets, that they both leave the symmetrical mark of Cain on the forehead as their symbol, a fact called out explicitly in both texts. Letter to the editor of the New York Times. I mean, the real headline item here isn't that Poirot died. He was freaking ancient, and we all do. It's that he killed. I repeat, he shot an unconscious man through the head and got away with it. Whew. All right, let's take a step back from that abyss. Had these novels been published one after another, Christie certainly would have been accused by critics and readers of recycling ideas, phrases even. And she was, but I think she was doing it with a purpose in mind. She was exploring a theme, crawling down a rabbit hole, following a difficult idea all the way to its inevitable conclusion. Look at Curtin and Then There Were None on a continuum with Murder on the Orient Express. On the Orient Express, 12 people personally wronged by a murderer who had walked free form an ad hoc jury and carry out their sentence. It's extra legal, but we're meant to feel a sense of uplift at this vigilante justice. Poirot's nonchalance about the whole affair gives that uplift a seal of approval, and no matter how much modern adaptations make Poirot wrestle with the morality of it all, he will always send the authorities on a wild goose chase for a small dark mafioso with a womanly voice who does not exist, meaning the 12 vigilantes are always absolved. Too easy. Take away the moral authority that affirms the vigilantism, no Poirot, poof, and take away the personal connections that help us feel a right is being wronged. What's left? An icky, queasy feeling. The mastermind behind the meticulous bloodbath in And Then There Were None finds 10 people pretty much randomly, the connection being that he's certain they caused a death. And he is right about that. Largely to sate his own psychosis before cancer takes him, he herds them all together into an unwinnable survival game show.
I have wanted, let me admit it frankly, to commit a murder myself. I recognized this as the desire of the artist to express himself. I was, or could be, an artist in crime.
He is both judge, literally, and executioner, literally, with no jury to check him. His sentence is always death. I could barely make it through And Then There Were None. I did not relish seeing humans, regardless of what they had done, stabbed, poisoned, and squished, under the pretense that they deserved it, both the death and the torture of knowing it was coming. Pretty much the only reason I kept pushing through was the mystery left at the center. Who was doing this? There's no Poirot to untangle that for us. Unless you're very astute, there are none. And there's still no revelation. Two detectives show up to an island with 10 dead bodies, and they can't make heads or tails of it. Then, in an epilogue, Christie gives us a confession by means of message in a bottle.
I shall enclose it and seal it in a bottle, and I shall throw the bottle into the sea. Why? Yes, why? It was my ambition to invent a murder mystery that no one could solve. But no artist, I now realize, can be satisfied with art alone. There is a natural craving for recognition which cannot be gainsaid. I have, let me confess it in all humility, a pitiful human wish that someone should know just how clever I have been.
It's this braggadocio, killing to serve his own ego, that sets this murderer apart from the 12 broken souls in Orient Express who all kill to serve the dearly departed Armstrong family. Poirot had always felt comfortable making a distinction between the two, the good and the bad, the right and the wrong, until he found himself in their shoes. He's not above bragging in his farewell note to Hastings, sent 4 months after his death. He scolds Hastings for not seeing the obvious and clever clues he left behind, as he has done for decades, and will continue to do even from the grave. But he signs off on a poignant note of uncertainty, which sounds very nearly like a rejoinder to his past self, so certain of who should pay and who should walk free.
I do not know, Hastings, if what I have done is justified. No,
I do not know. I do not believe that a man should take the law into his own hands. But, on the other hand, I am the law. As a young man in the Belgian police force, I shot down a desperate criminal who sat on a roof and fired at people below. In a state of emergency, martial law is proclaimed. By taking X's life, I have saved others' lives, but still, I do not know. It is perhaps right that I should not know. I have always been so sure. Too sure. But now I am very humble, and I say like a little child, I do not know.
So why did Agatha Christie kill Hercule Poirot? A once-in-a-lifetime front-page obituary kind of move. Was it because a German bomb might have struck her London home any night, and she needed to leave something to her children? Well, no, she could have written a nest egg Poirot mystery and left the little Belgian alive, as she did with her locked-away Miss Marple. Was it because he was just too old to keep alive? Well, it didn't seem to bother her for the subsequent 35 years she wrote Poirot, who kept getting older. So, not really. Was it because he overshadowed her other accomplishments, the thriving canopy tree that blocks out the sun from Marples and Mary Westmacott's and mousetraps? Turning him into a shriveled man and a murderer to boot sure sounds like petty revenge, until you actually read the send-off she gives him. It's a kiss goodnight, not a kiss-off. Maybe she did write a definitive final chapter out of love and protectiveness, as Laura Miller believes, so that he wouldn't, as Murder by the Book puts it, be
stranded in limbo. Or worse still, a prey to writers who would exploit you, not look after you properly, like they did to poor James Bond.
If so, joke's on her, because Sophie Hannah's writing her third official Poirot novel right now. Now, you want to know my theory? I think Agatha Christie wrote Poirot's death, wrote it at a time when she didn't know if she would be able to write another story, because she was a writer. And this was too good a story to pass up. She would leave no stone unturned, no creative cul-de-sac unexplored. This was the crucible Poirot needed to go through after the absolution of murder on the Orient Express. And it was the challenge Christie needed to set for herself after the grindhouse perversity of And Then There Were None. We live in an age where too many creators are unable or unwilling to pull the trigger and kill their darlings. Really and truly kill them. They want the front page headlines. Superman dead. But they also need him to anchor that tentpole next year, please. But no one knew from pulling triggers like Dame Agatha Christie. When it came to pulling this trigger, she wasn't going to let Poirot's immortality get in the way of a great ending.
Goodbye, cher ami. I have moved the amyl nitrate ampules away from beside my bed. I prefer to leave myself in the hands of the bon Dieu. May his punishment or his mercy be swift. We shall not hunt together again, my friend. Our first hunt was here, and our last. They were good days.
That's all for this episode of Iconography. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed our dive into the work of Agatha Christie. If you did enjoy the show, please take a little time and review Iconography on iTunes and help it find new listeners. You may have noticed there was a bit of a delay between the Guy Fawkes episode and this one, and that was because Carolyn and I no longer live in London, which is sad, but we live in Boston now, which should be an equally engaging iconography subject in its own right. That's right, we've got one more episode left in Season 1 on James Bond, and then Iconography is going to come back with Season 2. We're going from England to New England. So don't be shy. What icons do you want to see explored on Season 2? Hit me up on Twitter at Charles Gustine, CharlesGustine, or on Facebook, facebook.com/iconographypodcast. And while you're there, share your favorite Poirot, or even better, your favorite non-Poirot works by the Queen of Crime.